Welcome to the Startup Grind Podcast.
Starting a company is not for the faint of heart.
It's always questioning, tweaking.
Where we talk to entrepreneurs, venture capitalists, and thought leaders about how to build a great company.
Like my friends, like, you think you're crazy.
I think you got to be a little nuts.
And change the world in the process.
We optimize for impact instead of profit.
It's never been a more exciting time to be an entrepreneur.
From Startup Grind chapters across the globe.
The chapter director for Cape Town.
Boise, Idaho.
London.
Mala, Palestine.
Guangzhou, China.
And delivered to you every Monday and Wednesday.
It's a Startup Grind.
Hey there, and welcome to Wednesday's episode of the Startup Grind Podcast. Today we have a conversation with Alex Austin, founder and CEO of Branch Metrics, who is joined by Founders Fund partner and former SpaceX engineer Scott Nolan. Alex received an MS in electrical engineering and an MBA from Stanford. In between degrees, he spent 5 years building a solar panel manufacturing facility from scratch in Santa Clara. While at the Stanford Business School, Alex also built an SDK for Android and iOS that is now live on over 7 million phones worldwide. Alex is now the CEO of Branch Metrics, taking the lessons he learned as a mobile app developer to building a mobile linking platform that helps apps grow and give their users better experiences. Scott Nolan is a partner at Founders Fund, where he focuses on investments in technology-driven companies across sectors including energy, biotech, aerospace, healthcare, and advanced manufacturing. Prior to Founders Fund, Scott was an early employee at SpaceX. There, he helped to develop the propulsion systems used on the Falcon 1, Falcon 9, and Dragon vehicles, and was also responsible for the Dragon's capsule, thermal, and environmental control subsystems. Let's listen in to Alex and Scott's conversation from our Silicon Valley chapter.
So let's see, where should we start? I think most people are here to hear from you today.
Probably not.
Here, I think you guys, well, so let's step back for a second. We'll give you a chance to talk through what you do, what Branch is all about. But I think you guys are on a really interesting trajectory that not a lot of people get to experience. It's going from, you know, having one product and then kind of finding your product market fit, and then just seeing insane scaling. So I think it'll be good to talk through some of the stuff that comes along with that and some of the unique things that you've seen. And hopefully we can, you know, answer audience questions at the end. I got a brief background, talked about me. I'll just give a little bit more, you know, a few more details. So I'm a partner at Founders Fund. We're looking at all different sectors, all different stages. The number one thing we're always focused on is just trying to back companies that we think are going to redefine their industry and be around for 10, 20 years. So it's all about, you know, let's just find those companies, and it doesn't matter what stage they're at, what sector they're at, what geography. Actually, one of my friends who was interviewing with you guys introduced us. He said, you know, I just talked to this company. They're going to change the way that mobile discovery happens, and you've got to talk to them. And so he's like, yeah, and by the way, you're really going to get along with the company and get what they're doing. So we met up one afternoon and talked a lot about the vision of changing, you know, mobile discovery and search, and so here we are. So, I think we'll make this all about you and Branch tonight. Not to put you on the spot, but do you want to give? Maybe we should start with just like the overview of what Branch does, and like a super explicit, shameless plug, so that everything else after this cannot be advertising.
Yeah, so I'll try to make it like everything after this and the stories that I tell be as like real and true to probably a lot of the experiences that you guys are going through now, because I presume that majority of the group is our entrepreneurs actively working on companies. So let me give you a little description of what Branch is, because it'll help frame overall, like, you know, the rest of the discussion. But we provide deep linking as a service for apps. So you're probably like, what the heck is deep linking? And deep linking is a new concept. It basically makes an app have links like a website does. So an example is that, let's say Zappos.com, you maybe find like a pair of shoes that you think are really cool. You can send that link to that web page to a friend and be like, you love this pair of shoes. We allow you to do that with Zappos app too. So, you know, more real experience, the one you probably see like daily, you click on a link in your email for like a LinkedIn, for example, and it takes you to the website, even though you have the app installed and all set up. So we make the app actually open up and like show you the page you clicked on. So that's a little bit about what we do. And by the way, it's totally free to use. it will, like, you know, improve your business if you're a mobile focused business dramatically. So check it out, you know, do all that stuff. Branch.io is the site.
Cool. All right, advertisement over. Let's see. So I don't think a lot of people wake up in the, you know, wake up one morning in bed and say, I'm going to start like a mobile deep linking company. Like, how did this come about? You guys were working on something else before this, right?
Yeah. Oh, wow. So the, just adjusting to that volume. So the, we basically, like, just a little bit about myself, and it'll help frame the context of the transition, but I've been in startups now for probably close to 9 years, and I've been through some crazy, you know, ups and downs. The first company I worked on for about 5 years, I joined when there were about 20 people. We grew it to about 750 people. We had raised, I think, when I was there, it was about 30 million. We raised about 550 million over the course of the lifetime. And the company was ultimately sold for 30 million to a Chinese conglomerate. And like most of the people don't work there anymore. So like at one point, you know, I joined, it was probably worth about 100 million or so. And it was worth like 3 billion or something on paper. And, you know, everyone's like counting their, you know, stock price, like, and options, and then went to the, like, complete opposite extreme of that, too. And after I left that company, I saw a lot of what they did wrong, and I thought that I could genuinely do a better job myself. And so I made the commitment that no matter what, I would work on my own company. Like, I would build something from scratch, and this time not end up on the failure side of things, but, like, hopefully end up on the success side. And so over the course of about two and a half years, tried many different things, one which ultimately led to Branch. I was actually I was more of a physicist, so I studied electrical engineering and with a focus on device physics, if there's anyone that's actually more in, awesome. So, but I've always I did that because I found it incredibly hard to like mentally grasp some of the concepts, and I like that challenge of like not immediately knowing the solution when you're presented with a problem. But I always had this like hobby of software development. I would build a lot of apps on the side, mostly for desktop. When I quit, I had seen the phone start to take off. This was now like 2012, so it's actually like, you know, pretty advanced at that point. And I was like, I want to get involved here. The company that I build will be in mobile. And so I just started building apps to get familiar with the, you know, ecosystem. It turned out to be a lot harder to build a successful company than I thought it would be going through that process. And so I applied to grad school for a second time grad school down the road. And I applied to business school because I heard that you could actually go to business school, graduate, but like never do any work. Which turned out to not be true. You actually have to go to class.
It's all lies. That's maybe that was like in the 90s, and then I think too many people didn't go to class, so they changed the rules.
Yeah, exactly. Like that, yeah, somebody who graduated in 99 said that they never went to class. They were just like tanning by the pool all day, and I was like, awesome, I can like get a degree, take loans out, and fund my company based on, and like do all this work and never show up to class, but still get a piece of paper at the end so my parents would be proud.
It's like some like 2-year alibi or something.
Exactly,
like that.
Yeah. So it was actually a really good decision because it's where I met my co-founders for what ultimately turned into Branch. And so we built this one consumer-facing mobile app, very simple premise. We basically were selling printed photo books. So you download the app and you could use photos and like arrange them in a layout, and then we would handle the logistics of printing and shipping that photo book anywhere in the world. We got that business, we ran that out throughout like half of first and up and through second year of business school. We got that to be about like 700-ish K in annual revenue, but it wasn't growing really dramatically. Like it was like we always found it was incredibly hard to source the next, you know, 10,000 users for the app. And so we're always thinking about new ways that we could try to, you know, convince existing users to download, like, you know, get their friends to download or open up new discovery pathways. And one of the things we felt was missing was like a linking tool. We wanted the ability, just like very simply, I'll give you a use case where I create a photo book, I want to send it to a friend, and that friend maybe doesn't have the app, but would click on that link, then install the app, and then see that book right away as the first screen. It happens very naturally on the web, where like you can send links around and people click on it and see that thing, but it's like impossible to do that in an app. And so we couldn't find a tool to actually help us do that. That's deep linking, as I described before. So we built this thing actually for ourselves. And we used it for like sharing, referrals, a bunch of advertising, all with the intention of personalizing the user experience when the user like clicked on a link and then entered the app. And we basically graduated. The app was like growing all right, but it wasn't like anything to write home about. And we'll talk a little bit more, I think, about that later probably. But we got to this incubator, and all these other mobile companies saw this linking tool that we had built, and they're like, I want to use that too. And at that point, it was like a couple classes that I had written for Android and iOS. There was no documentation. It was like, you know, just this like super basic, like kind of like thing that I had built. And there was like immediately they were doing like going through heck trying to put it into their own app, like figuring out, dealing with all the bugs, like all this other stuff to use this linking tool that we had built. And meanwhile, we were struggling to get people to even like buy a photo book. And so this linking tool just started growing like crazy on its own pretty much. And so we made the decision by the end of that incubator session to sell off the photo book app and focus exclusively on the linking tool. So it's the same corporation. Our corporation now is like 3.5 years old, but the tool itself is about like 1.5 years old now. But you know, it's been a wild ride. So over the last 1.5 years, we went from like a few friends' apps using this linking tool, processing probably like, you know, 100 requests a day, to now we process easily over 1 billion requests a day, powering like, you know, links for Pinterest and BuzzFeed and like Zappos and others. So it's just been like a crazy last 1.5 years of, you know, scaling a company.
So yeah, before when you were working on the photo book product, like, you know, you'd put all this work into it, and obviously there's probably a lot of momentum around that, and you could say, well, you know, do we know if there's going to be a really big business in this deep linking tool? And we've got this photo book thing, so why not just keep working on it? We'll crack the code, we'll make it work. Like, how did you actually get to that decision that, yeah, we've found something here that's got really good product market fit, and there's some runway, and it's not something that just anybody can build in-house? Like, what was the thought process there that got you from working on this first thing and then really changing directions fundamentally? I'm sure it was probably not an easy decision to sell that off, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was making cash, which is nice. So I think the thing that's most important, and one of the things that I've seen now working on a bunch of, like, I've built probably about 8-ish apps, both Android and iOS, and gone through the like super excited idea phase, you know, product build, launch, and then shut down at the end because I didn't feel like they were working. And the app, the Kindred app, was really in the same bucket. And the process that I've seen that I think you have to set for yourself is one that isn't really talked about that much. Like, you hear mostly of these stories of people that were like born to build these companies, and they were like, you know, they wake up every day and it's like their sole mission in life is to do this thing, where really you have to be a bit more pragmatic about the decisions you make. You should know for yourself what success looks like. You should be able to say, like, you know, if I think forward 12 months from now, what does this product need to be doing for me to still be excited to like work on it as opposed to working for someone else? And that helps you set your own internal success criteria that you should apply to your own companies. So like, I think with the photo book app, we had some user growth goals. Like, we wanted to see a consistent, you know, new users buying photo books every month. And the other one was just overall conversion rate from initial install to actually purchase. And both of those goals, after continually working on them, like, we couldn't hit. Like, we knew the writing was kind of on the wall that there was like not a lot of, you know, this wasn't going to be a really big business. And for us coming out of it, that's really like, for our own personal success, we really wanted to be a part of like a fast growing, you know, venture fundable company. And so for us, like, we kind of, like, it was pretty painfully obvious. And honestly, coming to that realization for me was probably one of the hardest times of my life. Of, like, I remember there was like a couple of days where I had trouble getting out of bed because I was like, I had poured a year of my life into this product and done everything to make it perfect, like answering support emails from like angry Midwestern moms at like Saturday night. And like now coming to the realization that it would never be that like big thing that drove me to kill myself for, you know? So
as you set these milestone goals and ask yourself, are we hitting our goals? Like, were you guys, you know, there's like a few scenarios. You beat them, you basically hit them, maybe you fall slightly short, or you just don't hit them at all. And I think probably one of the really hard scenarios is you're in this weird middle ground where, okay, we're kind of hitting our goals. If we put a little bit more money into marketing, like, I could see us hitting them next month. Like, all we need is one more month. How do you think about, you know, okay, when do you say, no, this isn't quite working and we need to try something else? It can probably be really tempting in this middle zone, right?
Yeah, I think it's like with the photo book especially, because like we could probably pay rent for everyone that was working on it with the money we were making from it. And so it's like, you know, that was like, we were pretty proud that it was actually generating money, and to like decide that this wasn't going to be the thing that we continued to work on was a tough call. But like, you have to be, you know, regardless of what money you're making, like you have to be pragmatic about and stick to your, you know, success criteria that you set to make yourself happy. And if you're not seeing the growth numbers or whatever it is, then, you know, you got to make that call. Whereas with Branch, when we decided, like, let's give this a try, and we said, I think it was like, first month, we'll have 5 apps integrated. And then second month, we want to double it. And then after that, we want to double that. And we just kept, like, blowing through our goals every time. Like, it seemed like things were just getting better. And so we were excited to like come in and like push ourselves harder to see where it could go, you know? And you need to have that momentum in the beginning, because it only gets harder after that, so.
Yep, and everybody was on board with the new direction. That's probably one other thing, right? Like, what if you have a team where it's split and some people say, no, we should stay doing this thing we were doing? And have you ever encountered that before?
Yeah, I think it's so I've never, like, with our team, I think it's one of the best things that we've built is our founding team. So, you know, being together now for 3.5 years, we've been through that cycle a few times, and we are very pragmatic. We know we want to build a large, like, high growth company. And so for us, it was like, you know, this is we love our users, we love this product, but it's not as exciting as this like amazing thing that just seems to be growing like crazy and like solves a huge pain point that we personally just like felt ourselves. So we get to solve that pain point that we solve for ourselves, but now see that same, like, you know, that same reaction when we solved it in like, you know, thousands of other people too, which was like awesome. So yep. You must have had some at SpaceX too where you had to make calls like that too.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't making the calls, but yeah, you know, I think it's one of these things where the same milestones were set from day one, and you have to ask yourself, well, what's driving the milestones? And I think at SpaceX, it was really, this is going to be an expensive undertaking. We can't afford to try to launch a rocket 20 times with no success. Like, yet at the same time, we know most first launches don't work, so what do you do? So I think it was really one of these things where at SpaceX, Elon said up front, hey, we're going to try to do this three times, and, you know, we've got cash to go after it 3 times and get a successful launch. And, you know, the first 2 weren't that successful. Third one really almost kind of worked. It was like, it basically worked, except there was a little bit of instability in the upper stage. And at that point, I think everybody knew, okay, here's what's ahead of us. We pretty much got it to work, and number 4 is going to work. And so we had the money to, you know, do number 4, thanks to Elon, and it worked. I think if number 4 hadn't worked, it might be a different story. But I think a lot of times there's this question of like, when do you stop? When do you go on to the next thing? I think the interesting case of like, you can pay rent, but it's not going to be more than that, is a really tricky one. I think most of the time the world tells you, hey, it's time to stop because you kind of run out of money and there's nothing else to do. I think maybe the more important thing is identifying failure really early and just saying, no, we don't have product market fit. let's change directions before we're out of cash and before the world tells us that we're done here. So I think, how did you guys approach that in terms of, you know, or how are you even approaching it now? Like making sure you have the best fit with what customers actually want, as opposed to just saying, you know, here's what we're doing, it's working, let's not listen to feedback. There's probably two ends of that spectrum, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes back to the, it's even more dangerous now, I found, with Branch. We found this like amazing need that really any mobile developer has and see a lot of growth with the early product, but you have to continue to launch things to stay relevant and expand on that core use case. But you feel a lot more confident in your own abilities, that how you understand your customer at the stage where you have that, like you've had a success, and there's a huge risk that you get too smart for your own good and disconnect from, you know, your customer base when you get too prideful of like, you know what's best. You know, when you get into that, really the whole Apple thing of like, you know, what your customers want like better than they do is like total BS. Like, none of that, like, you can never get to a stage where you feel, that's like, if that thinking is so dangerous, it's like, you're either gonna, like, you know, succeed wildly or fail miserably, and it's gonna be, the likelihood of that wild success is like a fraction of a percent. So there's a tendency for companies that do a second launch to basically have, go very strategic of like, this product would make a lot of sense for our business. It's like, it would put us in a good spot, but they forget about that they're building for their customer base. And they end up building like a second product that actually doesn't, you know, meet a need that their customers have. And so we actually recently made this call with a product we were working on where it made a ton of strategic sense. It was gonna be like very valuable if in theory, if it would work, but we set some initial criteria of like, you know, we wanna have beta partners using it, you know, in the wild by like, you know, it was like 6 weeks after we started building. And we had trouble even from our earliest partners, like we had trouble getting anyone to sign up. They're like, oh, it sounds super cool, but like we'll put it in next quarter or like, you know, the quarter after. And it was like a dangerous thing where like you could kind of get this positive feedback that they were interested in it, but they wouldn't pony up to actually do it. And so we made the call of like, actually after investing like, you know, a month into this thing, that we got to shut it down. There's got to be something that's like actually more suitable for our customers. And you just have to make those like, you know, set those goals of like, you need to see this success because that's what you need to like achieve whatever next stage of the company or whatever goal that you're shooting for after that. And if not, then like move on to the next thing. So.
Yeah, so early on, I mean, you had some interest in the product. People, I guess you were talking about the incubator accelerator and people wanting what you'd built. And so, you know, to get to that point where you have the luxury of getting comfortable and saying we know everything, like how did you actually get to that point where we've got a product now that people really love? Is it, you know, product market fit? Is it just some magical thing that you stumble across, or is there actually a process that you guys use to get there?
Yeah, so I think for me, the thing that really triggered it was like with the photo book, I had to like photo book app, I had to convince my mom to download it and like start using it. And she was like, well, I use Shutterfly. And I'm like, ah, come on. Like ours is way better.
Like, come on, I'm your son. You gotta use it.
Whereas with like the linking thing, like people literally like they'd hear about it, not even from us, somebody else, and then come to us and ask to use it. And like still to this day, a lot of the people that come and use Branch are like, it's word of mouth referrals from friends. Like they hear about it and want to come use it. And
yeah, they're not all family members either, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I think for us, it was just like that feedback, like you need to have that type of momentum because like just, you know, if you're having to sell too hard, it's just probably not a good
so
idea.
I mean, you said it started as a couple libraries, a couple basic snippets of code to make this happen. How did you figure out, okay, we've got something here, people want it, now we're going to turn it into like a real product with like other features too, and how do we decide what features to have and not have? You know, I think that's a pretty basic thing, and you get like, you know, feature bloat and people get really obsessed over their own products and this is what I would want and I'm going to build all these things into it, and then after they're all done, I'm going to take it out to the market. Everybody's going to love it. Like, Or you just start, you know, doing whatever people tell you to do, like have no direction strategically in the product. How do you think about mapping that out?
Yeah, so like the way that I thought about it is, you know, I had, back in the early days, we had just myself and my other technical co-founder who were writing code. And it was like, we have a certain bandwidth of like things that we can build in time. And there is the risk that we could end up working on things that we think are really cool, extensions that weren't, you know, necessarily a need that the customer had. So what we did was we basically created this, and we don't actually use it now, but I was just like thinking we should probably incorporate it again. But the what we did is every time we'd go on a call with a potential partner who wanted to know more about it, we would make a list of every feature that they would repeat back to us. So we would say like a ton of different things, you know, like, oh, you can do this, you can do that. And whenever they would be like, oh, that sounds cool, we just make a note of it. And then what we did is we kept a big board in the office that were post-it notes filled with potential features that we could build. If somebody mentioned something on the call that wasn't there, we would add a new post-it note. And if it was already on the board, we would just add a dot next to that existing post-it note. And basically what we'd do, we'd be like, constantly building as fast as we possibly could. And as soon as we finished one thing, we'd go grab the next feature that had the most dots and then take that one off and then build that one and then move on like continually. We basically started to craft this product that was like hyper-focused on only the things that were most impactful to the largest number of people, which ultimately drove like, you know, continued to drive growth. So new features we add would excite like a whole new audience of people. And like, but we knew there was a need there because we'd literally been on the phone talking to that person who was like, I would love it if it did this. And then, so they'd use it too. And then they feel like you built it for them because you like, you know, you didn't necessarily have it when they suggested it. And then they feel like, oh man, like Branch is awesome. They're like doing everything that I say. Like I'm like helping to build the product. Which is really good for like community building and some other things too. But
cool. Yeah, early on, people in the, you know, in the incubator and in the accelerator, they were the people you were talking to sell this. I think after that, you probably send emails out to your network, you scale it that way. How do you actually go from those, you know, high touch, let's call every customer sort of thing to actually scaling sales beyond that, or scaling adoption? I mean, you can't forever just like write emails to people you know. That's not going to work for that long. You know, obviously there's like online marketing, SEO, like content marketing, but any hacks that you guys have found that are really helpful in just building that momentum without having to like every day scale up something that's not ultimately scalable?
Yeah, so this was not something that like we thought would actually be that useful, but reflecting back on it was immensely valuable. So coming from the photo book world where you're servicing like, you know, Midwestern moms who might not understand actually like how to use the app, and they get really angry when the book comes like, you know, half a day later than you said it would. And like, you get into this mode of like hyper customer service of like, you have to be there for your like your customers and like constantly service their needs. So when we started building this product, we were like insane about our customer support. Anytime somebody would write in, like I basically, first off, I was doing all of it. So anytime somebody would write in, I would like, you know, I'm like a zero inbox type of person. So like I would reply to them within like 5-10 minutes and like answer whatever question they had. And you start to build like this like relationship with these people. They're like, I don't get what you just said. Can you get on the phone? And you're like, you know, 5 minutes later, you're on the phone with that person, like walking them through whatever question they have. Like we started to build such a deep relationship with all of the early adopters of our tech who were there, like then like felt a part of Branch as a company. Like they felt like they were, you know, just as involved as building the various features as we were. And that paid dividends like crazy throughout the like over the last year and a half. Either for we basically have turned that early base of customers that we serviced really well into our community, who we actually do meetups all over the world as well, focused on mobile growth. We asked our partners who got a really great experience out of, you know, our customer support to come and speak about mobile growth, their tactics, all that kind of stuff, and they're willing to do it like in a heartbeat because they feel like they owe us for the, you know, service that we gave them. So if there's anything that, like, I would say that you should invest in and should be your absolute top priority when it comes to actually starting to like scale this product is support. Just treat those people, like the way I described it to everybody now is like, we should be so lucky that they even write us a letter. Like, it could be so much worse. Like, the worst thing is apathy, where they just like hear about the product and then leave and then never come back. Like, thank God they're sending us an email to ask us like how to do something. So let's treat them with the utmost respect, that like we should honor their presence, you know, among us. And just that relationship you build, like, you know, that person will do anything for you. They'll tell all their friends, you know, speak on your behalf. When we raised money, they were more than happy to hop on the phone with an investor and do diligence, like all that stuff. So treat those people like kings and queens.
Yep, and I guess that gets back to the, you know, the designing the product sort of thing, where, you know, by getting that feedback, you have a pretty clear idea of what your customers want. And it probably helps you, you know, not start thinking that you know more than they know. But yeah, at the same time, I guess part of the question was what's scalable. That doesn't seem, you know, you're probably not doing 24/7 customer support these days, right? I mean, you're not doing it at this very moment.
Yeah, so we're fortunate now where we're able to hire some really awesome people who do it. And one of them is actually here right now, Ahmed. but we and they, you know, treat our customers with the same respect. And I still like, but to be perfectly honest, you know, up until we were able to hire some really awesome people, I've been doing support up, like, you know, I think actually even when we were raising the Series B, I would come out of like an investor meeting and I would answer a like ticket. I spend a lot of like weekends if I can, because I think it's so important for every employee to know like the customers and what people are doing and like be involved with it. So we actually just also started a policy now where everyone from, you know, the most senior person to like our office manager will be on support for one day every couple weeks. And they basically, you know, are in the thick of it answering super technical questions just like our awesome support engineers. So.
Yeah, really cool. Yeah. Let's see. Yeah, where should we take this? Like, what's the next thing you think?
I think
it's worth covering that. Like, you guys have been through that. That's like an unexpected lesson that you guys have found, or you know, something like that.
I think you know, one of the things that I've come to realize, I think as we've scaled, and you do this naturally when you're in a small company, but we're now a little bit over 50 people. And one of the things that I've realized is like, you'll have these wins, you know, when things are going well, and it can cause a sense of like comfort. Like as an example, we had a competitor and like Pinterest was like their marquee client. And we, after like a very long, many month investment, stole that client away from them. And it was like one of the most satisfying, you know, things ever. And there's like a tendency to want to like kick back and like, you know, celebrate that win and like, you know, maybe go to into a mode where you show up to work and you're really comfortable. But it's really, really dangerous to do that, like extremely dangerous. Because one thing I found is there's always something broken. There's like something on fire and you don't always see it. Like, it might be something that's kind of like lurking, and it requires you to like, you know, maybe get a good night's sleep on a Saturday morning, just like think through like everything that's happening in the business and be like, one of these things is like not working well. And then I guarantee you, if you spend the time and do it, you will find one thing that's like not good enough. So never get into that mode of like, it's all good here. You know, we're at a point where we can like kick back and celebrate. It's like the next day you show up after stealing that big client, like spend the time and like take an inventory of everything at the company and make sure that like, you know, I guarantee you'll find something on fire. So.
Yep, it's like never rest on your laurels, right? I mean, I think the the other version of this I've heard is like, you know, somebody was talking to like a really successful group of people, or potentially really successful, and they were saying, you know, pretty much everybody here, as long as you don't think you're going to succeed, and you're just like always paranoid about failure, everyone here is going to do great. At the same time, if you assume that you're definitely going to succeed, or you get lazy, that's when you don't succeed. So it's kind of like one of these things. In addition to like believing that you can do whatever it is you're setting out to do, you have to also believe that you can mess up.
A quick break from Alex and Scott for some recent startup headlines. Twitter is set to stream Thursday night NFL football games, according to Bloomberg. Twitter reportedly outbid Verizon, Amazon, Facebook, and Yahoo to secure the online rights to the games. It is still unclear when or how the games will be presented on the platform, but reports speculate inclusion in the Moments tab. Facebook has rolled out an AI tool for describing images to visually impaired users. It would work as automatic alternative text. The tool identifies concepts and categories like car or airplane, or sushi, or pizza. The technology is still in its early stages, but Facebook is working to apply the method to video and a visual Q&A tool, which would allow users to ask questions about photos. Automated copywriting service Persado has raised $30 million in a Series C round led by Goldman Sachs, with participation from Bain Capital, American Express, City Ventures, and Starvest Partners. The software creates copy designed to engage with readers, and the company has raised $66 million to date. Let's get back to the interview.
Yeah, like in... I think Andy Grove, of course, has the quote, only the paranoid survive. Like when we were with the solar panel company, we actually paid a guard to stand out by our trash 24/7 to make sure that nobody would go through and like sift through our trash. Because somebody had caught one of our competitors at the solar panel company like digging through our trash looking for samples that they could come back, go back and analyze. And so it's just like, there's always something broken. And you have to like, you know, constantly be vigilant. And a more relevant like branch story, I remember in May last year, we, I took a step back and it was like prepping for a board meeting and I pulled this one piece of data to try to analyze a little bit about like growth trajectory. And the way I plotted it, it became clear to me that like growth was like kind of flattening out. I was like, okay, well, what's like, something's going wrong here. Cause we've been like, it felt like things were like exponential up until this point. And we basically felt like we were hitting kind of a wall.
Yeah. What was it like? How did you discover this? Cause I mean, on the surface, it probably did look exponential, right?
Yeah, so it's like, because I, you know, there's a tendency, even when you get to a certain point, the curves, like, even if you start to are linear, like, it's clear that you're actually not growing as fast as you are, but the curve still looks like exponential, because, you know, that exponential curve is like, kind of can, you know, become a line.
You need to do, it has to be log plot, right?
Exactly,
or at
yeah.
Log y-axis.
Yeah, never, so we actually plot log scale on all plots now for the board meeting. But the, like we basically found just like, and I spent an entire weekend just digging through all data that I possibly could. And I found that it was like 60 or 70% of our signups were all happening in the Bay Area only. And we're a developer tool. And just like, you know, quick Googling around, I could find that the majority of app developers were not based in the Bay Area. So there was clearly something wrong about like the way that we're marketing and, you know, building a community such that we had like saturated effectively the Bay Area in terms of customer base.
Yeah, what were you doing at that point? Like why just the Bay Area? Were you doing meetups here and ads only here?
Like we found that this might be specific to developer tools, but it is a very word of mouth driven product. You know, people tell their friends, like, you know, you're hanging out with your friend who's probably a developer at a company, and they'll mention this cool tool that they found or whatever. So it is like, you know, a very like local growth that comes through this like word of mouth for developer tools specifically. And so to help foster that, we actually started doing meetups focused on mobile growth and then getting, as I mentioned, our partners to do it. And I think we had basically focused exclusively on Palo Alto and SF. And we were doing those over and over. I think in one of like an awesome, our biggest one had like 550 people or something up in the city, and that was like probably the month before. And so we felt like things were amazing. I was like, how the heck is growth plateauing? And when we found it was like, holy crap, we're just like super saturated in the Bay Area. Literally, I think it was within 3 weeks, we had meetups in like three other cities, and we flew people there, and then suddenly things started taking off again. And so it was just like, you know, it's one of those examples of like, I guarantee something is always broken or about to break, and you just have to be watching diligently. So,
yeah, it's almost like if growth, you know, either growth is broken or you're growing so fast that it breaks something else. There's probably that version of it too, right? I mean,
yeah. I mean, the what it's been a like an absolutely for us, especially just scaling from we had like a, you know, a single node API server and a node powered link server and one SQL database, and that was powering like 10 apps just fine. And when we started to process like, you know, hundreds of thousands of requests per second, like one of our API calls was making like 20 database queries, and things started to crash. But meanwhile, like apps are onboarding, like things are growing like crazy, and we're like, you know, so like, this new app flips on and we die like immediately, and we're like, what the heck, you know. We, you know, it was like, holy crap, like we're not going to survive this. And like getting to the point where you have to like tell them to hold off while you quickly go re-architect your whole like method of storing data is like, you know, it's another problem to deal
this
with.
This is not the type of thing where downtime is acceptable, right?
Yeah. I mean, so now we're like, you know, I think we had like 5 nines on our links over the last couple of weeks. So it's like, we don't, it's like so far from, and that's, but you know, a little more than a year ago, we were just going through hell trying to keep everything running. So, anyways.
Yeah, I remember at one point, I guess, thinking back to the customer service point you were talking about, I think it's one that a lot of people don't talk about. And, you know, sure, you hear companies like Zappos talking a lot about customer service and how important that is, but not a lot of, you know, high growth startups are really talking about that, especially like consumer internet, these sorts of things. So, I remember though at one point you had some hack that you used that would tell you immediately if a company was good or not, right? So like I think a lot of people here are startup people, like working at startups, but for those of the people in the audience that are investors, what was your hack?
So my fiance is also in venture, and she's always looking at new cool companies. By the way, she's at Cowboy, so you have a really if you have a great idea, I can forward it on to her. But I'm going to put a filter.
Or Founders Fund.
anyways, but the
either way, to test, we can co-invest.
I mean, I'm like, you know, like I personally, like our unit, our portfolio is invested in, you know, Cowboy. So, but anyway, so whenever she's evaluating like a, you know, a company, I tell her to test them by sending in a support request, make a fake email account to like, you know, with a fake name, and then send a support request in on like Saturday afternoon, and just count how long it takes for one of the founders to get back to you. And if it's like, you know, not till Monday, it's probably not a good sign for that, because she's doing, you know, early stage company, so probably not a good sign. So, so if you guys are ever getting diligence by Cowboy, you better be answering support tickets on Saturday.
Just watch out for those fake email addresses, right? You never know. So let's see. So I think we've covered a lot of stuff. Anything else? I mean, I'm trying to think. Anything we haven't covered?
Yeah, I think like one of the other big takeaways that I also don't hear a lot of people talking about, and then maybe we can open it up to questions after this. But so ultimately, so I worked at this solar panel startup for 5 years, and I literally killed myself for this company. And it was like a, you know, the way that it worked is we pushed a tool, we started up a tool, it would run consecutively 24 hours straight for 7 days. And you would be operating it like all through 24 hours. And so on the R&D team, you're responsible for just continuing to run experiments on this tool. And so you might have an experiment that you would run, you know, from 3 a.m. to 7 a.m. And so there were times when I would like literally go like, you know, 3 or 4 days without sleeping, running my experiments to try to get it done. So like I literally almost killed myself for this company. And ultimately what happened was like strategically in the long run, they had set the company up for failure, and like it wasn't talked about. It might have been discussed at board meetings, but there were you know, decisions made about the product that ultimately killed the company.
Well, and what were they optimizing for? Like, why make those bad decisions?
So the like basically what had happened is, and it sounds silly in hindsight, but like, you know, probably a few billion dollars were poured into the solar panel industry. The premise of our product was that we could do like create solar panels at a lower cost than, you know, traditional manufacturer. So our competitive advantage that we were gunning towards was cost. And meanwhile, if you just plotted like the cost per watt is the, you know, the standard metric, if you plotted the cost for a traditional solar panel, it would have shown that we would have been irrelevant by the time we were ready to launch the product. So there were decisions made to like basically set us up for failure. And these were made at like, you know, some of the best investment firms in the Valley, very, very intelligent people who would get in a room for board meetings, you know, every other month and like agree that that was the right thing to do. And so when the company ended up failing, it was like, well, like, of course, like, it makes a ton of sense why we failed. And I think the lesson that I took away from that, and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to start like a company and try to set product strategy, is that you constantly need to be thinking about those like macro trends and where you fit within them, especially now where, you know, it's so easy to build a company on top of a platform like, you know, a Slack or, you know, iOS or Android. Like, you're on such shaky ground and you're dependent on these other ecosystems to, and like the changes that they make. So, you know, like an iOS update or a Slack rolls out an update, or like, you know, there's probably, you've heard about like when companies depend on Twitter's API or whatever. Like, when you depend on these things, like, you can't have those vulnerable spots or you will die. Like, you can't depend your entire well-being on the fact that there's like something available that's that you exclusively have access to. And so when it comes to like building Branch now, I am like always trying to think about, like, I was just telling Scott, like, I have a document where I have like the 5-year roadmap that I foresee based on friends that I know at Google and Apple of like upcoming things that we anticipate them to launch that we can set ourselves up to block against if there's something that's threatening to us. So it's just like, you know, while it's like easy to get caught up in the day, like the today, like what's going on now and the problems that you're facing now, you constantly have to think about, like, take a step back. And it's good to do it on like a Saturday after like a good night's sleep, but like take a step back and like think about where you fit into the broader like platform that you're operating on, because it will kill you if you're not careful.
Yep. Yeah, it's about that long-term strategy to be around for 10 or even 20 years, right? I think a lot of companies and a lot of people during their first startup underestimate that importance. So one thing we focus on a lot is, and we've talked about this, I mean, I think during, right before our investment, we spent hours and hours just talking through the strategy of how you stay relevant for 10 or more years. And I think the thing that people forget about is, if you're an early stage startup, most of the revenues you're ever gonna earn are, you know, they're certainly not this year. They're not even in the first 5 years. They're actually, on average, most of your cash that's gonna come in the door, if things work, is more than 10 years out. So this question of how do you like position yourself and set up barriers to entry that are either like technology or network effects or, you know, any of the common ones, how do you build those into the business strategy from day one to put yourself on a really good course for that? And so I think that's something that some investors think about. I think nobody thinks about it as much as they should. I think most startups don't think about it as much as they should. And I think the really great companies, like all the great companies, you think about it, they're not going away in 3 years. They're going to be around for a while. So, you know, I think that has implications about revenue. Like, when do you optimize for revenue? Do you try and make money day one? Or is it better to just constantly be strategic and constantly try and grow? Don't worry about revenue ever. I think there's a balance there. I think sometimes revenue can be a strategic weapon. It can help you, like, you know, fund R&D effectively. It can help you test the market. So I know, you know, this is stuff we've talked about a lot. And yeah, it's always the fun part of things is thinking through the strategy. And then you got to get down and actually do it. So in any case, yeah, maybe we open it up.